This week on the BOAG World Show, we're joined by interaction designer Adam Silver, whose career has taken him from Tesco's and the BBC to the UK government. This week's show is sponsored by Optimal Workshop and the Project Managers School. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG. Joining me on this week's show is obviously Marcus Lillington. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul.
Just wave. You forget the audio component.
I said hello as well. I did both aspects. Professional me. See, I can do it all.
Yeah. And more importantly than Marcus, we've also got Adam Silver. Hello, Adam.
Hello, hello.
It's good to have you on the show.
It's good to be here.
So I hear great things about you, Adam. You come highly recommended. Marcus. Marcus at Smashing Magazine.
Oh, he's awesome, Marcus, and very kind.
He is very kind. He basically told me that I had to have you on the show, otherwise there would be serious consequences. So... although he didn't need to threaten me, because I would have quite happily had you on the show anyway, but there was threatening, there was crying and begging. It was quite pathetic, really.
But, I've seen
yeah, there, and also a complete lie. But what happened was he was talking about the book that you've been writing for Smashing Magazine, or have written now. It's out, isn't it? So tell us a little bit about the book.
So the book's called Form Design Patterns, and the subtitle is A Practical Guide to Designing and Coding Simple and Inclusive Forms for the Web.
Ah, I see.
So it's kind of, there's like 10 main chapters where take some sort of chunky problem and step through all the options for it, analysing those options, and end up with an actual technical solution with code off the back of it at the end of each chapter.
Ooh. Give me an example
would be, the first one was a registration form, which is, you know, made up only a few fields. Second one's a checkout flow. Third one's booking a flight online. But each one of those things, they sound relatively simple maybe at first hand, and then you break them down and there's like really nitty gritty design problems in there with some really interesting solutions for them as well.
So, Paul,
and that's
Paul,
a fascinating.
I've just got to pull you up on the fact there that's somebody who writes a book that's both inspirational and useful. You know,
you're an arse, Marcus. But I got to say, a book like that really appeals to me, because form design, I think, is like the and it has a sensible name. Paul has just said in the chat room, arse to you, Paul. He's thinking about what I wanted to call my next book, which had the strap line. I can't even remember the strap line now. It's gone out of my head, but it was basically very rude and we're not really going to use it. Form design, I think, is one of those kind of on the surface, it's like you're just whacking a form, but it's the hardest thing to get right as an interaction designer, because it's where you're reliant on the user doing something that's quite complicated. So it always goes to pot, doesn't it, really, if you're not careful?
If you think about it, most of the interactions we have are actually through a form of some sort.
Yeah.
You know, if you're not reading or clicking a link, you're basically interacting with the form. You're creating something, you're editing something, you're deleting something, you're ordering something. Mm. Yeah, so it all revolves around forms. And so they seem so boring and so well covered. And yeah, I think actually behind everything there's a form front and center.
Yeah, I don't think that, there are anywhere.
So it's the thing that every normal person complains about. You know, like any non-webby people, they always complain about, when I was booking the flight, that's a classic, and then it dumped me out or whatever, and it didn't remember who I was, or I was left hanging, all of those kind of things. Absolutely the case. But I just wanted to say that this is doubly reminded me of the fact that I spent a day doing usability testing on Wednesday.
How did it go?
Really, really good. But you are reminded, everyone in this profession should do usability testing, in my view, probably once every 3 months minimum, to remind yourselves how other people use the internet. This is the classic one. This was find of the day. by three testers, three different testers. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you could click on the logo to go back to the home page.
Wow.
I'll just leave that one with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And forms are another really good example. Things like tabbing between forms, form fields. Mm. You know, most people don't know that they can do that. And then also, the other thing with that is when those people do know and the designer hasn't designed it in so that it tabs in a logical order. It jumps all over the place, which is why I'm so pleased that what you said when you started talking about this book, Adam, is that you haven't just done the looked at the design elements. You've also looked at the code elements, and you used one word that made me very happy, which was accessibility and the accessibility of this kind of stuff as well. So, you know, sounds a really good book. I might actually.
It's funny because the way I guess we'll get into this in a bit. I think you've talked about it in more of your other shows, but design is so much more obviously than just the way it looks, and yet we kind of think that that's what it is. And I'm sort of pitching to the choir here, but I'm just you touched on it, and I just wanted to say again, really.
So you call yourself an interaction designer? Is that right? Is that the title you've given yourself?
Yeah, that's the one I've settled on.
Fair enough, because it's fascinating the titles that people come up with, because, you know, who knows
job titles.
Yeah.
Job titles are one of those things, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So do you work for yourself or do you work for somebody else? I mean, I know you've worked for Tesco's in the past. You've worked for the BBC. You've worked for the UK government. Are you still at the UK government?
Yeah, I'm currently working as a contractor for Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunal Service. Excuse the mouthful.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, so it's like designing services like letting users apply for a divorce online or apply for a civil money claim or appeal a benefit that's been taken away from them.
So hence the book on form design, you know, really complicated, difficult stuff. Yeah. So you work as a contractor. Is that how you operate, going from company to company?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been contracting for more than 10 years now.
Wow.
I started off as a perm. It's one of those situations where I came out of uni, got myself a perm role, two different roles actually. So first one was for about 12 months. Then I got another one for another 18 months. And then at that point I was like, I'd ended up stumbling across this world of contracting. And I worked with like a whole bunch of contractors, and I was relatively junior, and I was in charge of about five or so front-end developers. I say in charge. I don't want to say like really in charge, but like I looked over their code and reviewed their stuff. And so I turned around to my employer and said, you know, you're paying me relatively not very much. Can I have just a few grand more? They said no. And then that was it. And then I was like, okay, well, if I can't really beat them, I'll just join them. And then I've been a contractor ever since.
Right. So you tend to work for extended periods of time with one client rather than being a freelancer that just works on one little project at a time.
It's definitely more contracting than freelancing.
But
I have a limited company, like both would, I guess.
Well, yeah it would do either way. All right, that's really interesting, because I don't think we've not got anyone else on this series that is doing the contracting side of things. You know, it's normally, you know, you interact directly with a client to deliver on a project as a freelancer or as a consultant or something like that.
Yeah.
So where do your contracts come from? Do you use some kind of agency or something?
So it's been varied over the years. And
right.
I mean, going back to your previous point quickly, I like roles that last a long time, then you can get into the nitty gritty of it. But that's not always the case. Sometimes projects have been cancelled, so I've been let go after, you know, a number of months. But my current role, I've been in it for 10, 11 months.
Oh, okay.
Something like that. I'm in the middle of a 6-month contract. So those things can roll on. Maybe it gets cut short. You never really know.
Yeah.
But in terms of how I get my contracts, same as a permie, really, either through an agent or word of mouth. I mean, the last 3 or 4 jobs have just been somebody that I know that has just reached out and said, oh, by the way, there's a job over here. Do you fancy it? And it sounded really good. And that was it.
So it
was good because I got to avoid recruitment agents. Yeah.
So are you concerned when a contract is coming up to the end? Like, where's the next job coming from? Or have you normally kind of got that in place ready to go?
I would Yeah, I mean, I would try and get early sight of if I'm going to be finishing the current contract or not. And it is one of those things where when I was young and didn't have a family, I was just like, oh, it's fine. I didn't really care too much. And I ended up getting a bunch of contracts. My first contract, actually, this is quite funny. My first contract was for 2.5 years and was my longest role ever. I've never had a role longer than 2.5 years, and it was as a contractor. So yeah. I kind of got that kind of put a good foundation in place in terms of my confidence. Mm. And then now, as I've got older and I've got more responsibilities, I'm like, oh God, I've got to make sure I keep on having a job lined up and stuff like that. I get more worried about it these days, actually.
Yeah. Sorry to bring that up, but it's a concern for all of us, whatever role we're in, except unless you are a permanent member of staff. Something.
But even with being a permanent member of staff, you could get fired with a month's notice and you don't see it coming.
There's not that much more safety in it, I don't think.
And also, you get the advantages.
We'll move on.
Yeah. Well, this is why I like running my own business, because although you have the pressure of bringing in work, at least I can see, oh shit, I'm running out of work. So, you know, and I can see it coming. Mm. While when you're a permanent employee, one day someone might just turn around and say, sorry, mate, you're out of a job.
Yeah.
And of course, the advantage with being a contractor is the rates tend to be typically higher because they're paying a premium for that flexibility to be able to drop you if they need to, you know. So
there's an advantage as well in always needing to sort of be on your toes. And you go to different companies, you get more skills quicker, you're exposed to more things. And then you never really feel, and because you don't feel, because for me, there's an element of that worry. Mm. It keeps you on your toes. So I'm constantly, I mean, I love what I do. So it's fun to keep on top of those things and just keep on learning it, making sure that you are as good as you can be. To hopefully get yourself a job easily.
Yeah,
absolutely. Cool. Well, all of that was a complete tangent, except it's very much in line with the theme of the show, which is about kind of careers and what we do for a living. But I was interested because I've never worked as a contractor. I've been permanent, I've been a freelancer, I've run an agency, but I've never been a contractor. So it's an interesting world. I just want to very quickly talk about our first sponsor, and then I'll get into some better questions for Adam. Well, not better, more prepared questions for Adam. So I want to talk about the Digital Project Manager School, which is an interactive learning experience. Sounds so cool, does it? Interactive learning experience. It's an online course, but that doesn't sound as cool. It's got video lessons, it's got a weekly panel discussions, it's got assignments and group discussion and coaching sessions all around, as you would guess from the name, digital project management. And really, it's for a whole load of different people in different positions. And because it's not a purely video course, but there is this kind of interactive nature, it can adapt to you. So if you're trying to land or have just landed your first proper project management role, it can work very much for you. It can work well for those who are trying to boost their skills and confidence. As you know, Adam was saying, you've got to stay on top of your game. And so this would help you do that. Especially if you're starting to manage more complex projects. It's also for seasoned project managers who want to refine their approach and stay up to date. And, you know, if you just feel like you want to do some career development and you want to do it at your pace in a kind of fun and, nice way without having to go traipsing to some, you know, lifeless, you know, sunless room somewhere. Why do all, whenever I run workshops, I always end up running them in a basement room somewhere with no natural light. I don't know what happens, but anyway. So they've helped people like Sony Music, Microsoft, Siemens, Dow Jones, lots of people like that. If you want to join up, keep an eye out for their next course, which will be coming up soon. And you can find out more by going to thedigitalprojectmanager.com/BOAG World. Right, Adam, back to you. So you're an interaction designer. My first question, therefore, for you is, where does that start and stop? You know, where's the edges as far as you're concerned? Because we've already established it includes a bit of coding. Mm. So where are the edges as far as you're concerned?
I think it's it's a really difficult one. I was just saying before we started recording to Paul that when I saw this question as a potential one for this for this show, I was like, it said, you know, what's an interaction designer? Where does it start? Where does it end? And I was just like, that's deceptive, that question, because it sounds so simple, and I really should know because that's what I call myself. But actually, it's really. Yeah. I was like, this, I need to get my act together and go work out what the hell it is that I do.
But it's true, isn't it?
What do you say to your mum?
It's true. So many of us. Yeah, what do you say to your mum? How do you describe your job to your mum?
I would describe it as I would use an example, probably. I'd say, you know, I design, you know, if you want to apply for a new passport and you need to go on a website and get a new passport renewed. Or if you want to go onto Amazon and buy a product, I help design those things.
Yeah. But as Paul,
that's a good way of doing it.
But as Paul says, you could do that on paper if you wanted to, and you don't have to do you don't have to design what it looks like. You could almost do it as a bullet point list. I'm not suggesting you would, but you know, why do you do the code part of it as well? I suppose is the question, and do you do the aesthetic part of it as well?
I think there's, so to talk about what an interaction designer does, where they start, where they end, I think you have to go one higher level. So when I was, it's funny because when you were saying, well, how would I describe it to my mum? I would say what I said, but it's, I don't do the whole of that thing. I do a part of that thing. And so what's the thing?
Yeah.
So then the thing is, I would say user experience design or service design. And to me, those are synonyms, basically. I can't really tell the difference between service design and user experience design, even if that's not how people interpret those words. So for me, so
I've written a whole blog post on the difference between those two. But yes, we won't go in that rabbit hole. But yeah, I know what you mean. It's very hard to differentiate it.
It's like everything that a person experiences, that makes up the entirety of user experience. Everybody is responsible for helping to deliver that. Anybody that works and helps shape the user experience of a thing is essentially a UX designer, which is why I would sort of say that title is a bit of a problem in a way, and which is why I specifically don't call myself UX designer, because I don't believe that I am responsible for the whole of it. I feel like I'm responsible for, if we're going to get into that level of detail now, it's like I feel like I'm responsible for the digital bit of it. And that usually ends up being screens that users see when they type a URL into their browser. Mm. And I appreciate that it might not always be a browser, it might be an app. But for me, I specialize in the web platform. So for me, it's that. Mm. I was just going to say, because your original question was, where does it start and where does it end? And that's a very tricky question as well, I think. Mm. I think an interaction designer should be involved from the discovery, you know, from the very beginning of a potential service being created. And by service, I mean a service, a product, a website, an app. Mm. Could be any of those things or a mixture of them. I think an interaction designer should start there at the beginning. And I think their job ends not when they deliver a picture of a thing or even a prototype of a thing or even a video that describes all of those things, but actually when that thing is in the hands of a user and it's actually meeting their needs or potentially, you know, or with a bit of luck exceeding their needs. Yeah. I don't know if my role ends until that point.
I don't think it does. I completely agree with that. You might not be as active in it, but you're still engaged with it up until the point of release. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like I might be involved in discovery, but I may not be absolutely part of the entire strategy of that. I'm helping to be part of the discovery. And then maybe the user researcher is more integral there, more important or more dominant at that stage of the delivery. And then you get more involved during alpha and maybe beta. And then when it's handed off to live, you get, it's like what you say, that then the curve goes back down and I'm less involved at that stage.
Yeah. And I'm really glad you distinguish between what you do and a user experience designer, because you get so many of these UI/UX design roles, which just drives me nuts, because I want to describe myself as a user experience designer. because I look holistically at the entire experience, both online and off, and, you know, and I care as much about the service design aspects of how the organization delivers that, etc.
Yeah.
But I've had to almost drop the word designer, and I call myself a user experience consultant, simply because if I say user experience designer, everybody thinks of a user interface designer.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a difficult one. There is interesting language about it. And yes, to some degree, it's all semantics. And yes, to some degree, it actually doesn't matter. But it also, for me, a user experience doesn't stop at the edge of the screen. And that's essentially what I think you were driving at. Yeah. Well, you focus more on the, you know, the screen, the interaction. Yeah.
But even what I might do, I might want to do something. Like, I might, if I understand something, or if an interaction designer understands something that happened out of discovery, or there's a user need, it might get me thinking about, well, what's the, how could this thing that I have in my head be delivered by backstage processes? Mm-hmm. And it also goes the other way around. So that's me trying to influence the service design bits of it. And then there's the other way around, which is, well, the service designer knows how things work today, knows how it may work tomorrow. And then that will influence what I can do on the screen.
Yeah.
Like they may, like, for example, I don't know, if you're designing a registration flow, there might be an offline process that validates that user. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what does that process look like? How long does it take? How long does it sit in this bucket? I may want to change the way that that whole underlying flow works, but that's not my responsibility. But it's like the edges. It's where the edges sort of cross.
Mm. Yeah. And that's where it's those edges where I'm interested, right? Yeah. I love those, you know, bits where, okay, so, you know, we've got this existing process to validate this particular form. But the optimal user experience is this. Where do we make the compromise? Who shifts? You know, do we redesign the back end system, or is it that the front end needs to change? And so often the default is, well, we've got what we've got in the back end. You know, that's it. And it even goes into other areas as well. So compliance, you know, it must be something that comes up with you all the time. When some lawyer turns around and says, we've got to put this disclaimer text on the form, making the form considerably harder to use. But actually, in truth, there is ways of interpreting and acting upon the legislation that underpins that. And there is room for maneuver and back and forth over it. So, yeah that's where it gets right. It's really
there may even be like policy within a business constraint that you can. Mm. Your job as a designer, not necessarily interaction designer, but all designers, all people that influence the experience, somebody has to fight to change those constraints and tweak those constraints, which is where you, which is what it sounds like you would be doing a lot of. And actually, it's interesting that you call yourself a user experience consultant because of the trickiness of job titles. And I was thinking, off the back of knowing what we might be talking about today, I was thinking, well, what if I think UX designer is a bad title, then is service designer a bad title? And we have that title in government. Mm.
Yeah.
And I really respect what they do, and they are designing services, but they're not designing every bit of it.
No.
But they design all the bits that you're talking about. So I'm like, I said to myself, is service designer a good title? Service design is a thing. Mm. Is service designer a title? And if it's not, what would you call it?
Mm-hmm.
The person that deals with those bits.
Yeah.
Behind the scenes.
We've got to get beyond this idea that a designer is somebody that produces visuals, you know, because designing an experience, especially when you get into the word experience, a lot of those elements of an experience are not something you look at. They might be, you know, an interaction that you have, or there's all kinds of different possibilities. But going back to the service design versus user experience, that's a really interesting one, because I think really the only difference between those two, as I cover in the article, by the way, I'll put a link in the show notes to the article if anybody's interested in it. But essentially, I think the difference is one of perspective, right? So a service designer starts by looking at the process that's happening in the organization, how that process can be improved, and by extension that then improves the user experience. A user experience designer starts from the premise of what does the user want, and that informs what the organization has to do. So that's why I would always call myself a user experience designer rather than the service designer, because I always want to start in my own methodology and way of seeing the world. I always start from the user's need.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
There is so much overlap between these different roles.
It's, I mean, funny enough, you talked about process a lot there, so I'm wondering maybe that's a good name for it, process designer.
Yeah.
I don't know. Doesn't sound quite as nice, does it?
No. Doesn't sound as cool.
No, it doesn't.
And also, the trouble is a big part of what I do is nothing to do with official processes and everything to do with people, culture, change management, those kinds of things. So that's a different... Who's interviewing who here? I was supposed to be talking about your interaction design. I'm getting into the conversation. Okay, right. Let's try and grab it back. I'm interested in your career path. How did you get to do... Did you train as an interaction designer? You look young enough that you might have been able to. Such a thing may have existed in university when... or have you come a different route? How did you get here?
So I'm going to go back all the way to GCSEs. No, not GCSEs. Am I going to go back to GCSEs? No, I'm going to go back to A-levels where I was doing an ICT course, IT course. It was a double A-level thing. If you remember those, if they're still called that these days, I'm so old now.
Who knows? You're so old. Yeah. My God.
Yeah, I know. We're dead, Marcus.
We're totally and utterly dead.
We've deceased.
Yeah. There's a few grey hairs, I promise you. this is why I shave it. There was one module called web design, and in that, I was learning HTML, and that's where it began. And it was like it was really good because I loved it because it was a mixture between creativity and also logic in terms of coding and stuff. So I started there, got really interested in it. I found forms, and I was like, so I got a form on the screen. And I was like, well, when I press the submit button, nothing happens. What do I do there? And I was like, as we did back in the day, or maybe even still today, we looked at view source, and we were like, well, how does it work? And there was nothing, there was just an action on the form. It didn't do anything. Yeah. So then I started to get obsessed with Amazon and shopping baskets. And I tried to work out how those things worked. And I was like, oh, I need to learn back-end development. That sounds really complicated and way beyond me. So then at that point I finished off the course and I went to uni and I studied multimedia technology, where I was just obsessed with learning classic ASP and ASP.NET and all those technologies. that's how long ago. And then I came out of uni and I got myself as, I think the role was just web designer / web developer. Mm-hmm. And I was basically, if I'd have got that job today, you would have called it full stack. I did HTML, CSS and JavaScript. I did some design in Fireworks, not that I was a particularly good at graphic design. I set up SQL servers, databases, and I even managed the client. And this is my first job out of uni. So I don't want you to be impressed by this. It's just I did all those things.
No, that was the way it was. You know, for a long time, you know, you did everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did you go from doing... Because obviously you had a very broad skill set and you've got to narrow that down. And you've just said that I wasn't particularly good at the design side. You seem to be leaning... You seem to be leaning very heavily towards the code. And now you're an interaction designer. So how did that happen?
Yeah, it's like so... Whilst I don't think I was particularly good at producing designs, every one of my designs that I would do and my hobbies would just have like boxes. I would just, you know, my family used to take the mic. Oh, look, you've done a design, and there's another design, and there's another box, and there's a box within the box, and that's what I thought. That's for me. That's what design was. I knew it was rubbish, but I couldn't put my finger on why it was rubbish. I felt like I always had a good eye for it, but I couldn't actually produce it myself. But like you say, I was much more focused on the coding thing, and I was quite good at it. Or I thought I was quite good at it. And so I ended up focusing on front end, because I was quite good at HTML, CSS, and I was okay at JavaScript. And I asked so many questions at this first agency that I was joining of all the back end developers that I felt like I should just focus on the front end. And then having become a front end developer, my next job was actually as a front end developer specifically. And I worked with, in those days, I was working with all sorts of designers. There was information architects, there was UX designers, there was visual designers, And they would hand over assets to me, and I would have to build them. You know, I wasn't involved with the design. Sometimes you challenge a few things, you try to make things a bit more accessible, you'd ask a few questions, but that would be at most, that's what you'd do. And you'd basically take those designs and slice them all up and code them up. And that was my job. And then over the years, dealing with the browser and getting to know the way the browser works and seeing problems that happen when you try to build a design that isn't necessarily that materially honest for the web, you end up starting to think about how things could be better for users along the way. It just becomes part of your job.
Yeah.
And eventually I got a job. So I was a front-end developer for quite a long time, just hopped from front-end development role to development role. And I just found myself increasingly moving towards design. And what I mean by that is I'd either make a nuisance of myself and just try and get involved in the design process earlier, or I just naturally move towards sitting next to a designer and then just getting more and more involved that way. Yeah. And making more bolshy statements of how I think the design should be.
That's how career progresses, isn't it? By getting more and more bolshy.
I think so. I think I was just an arsey developer. and then I was like, okay, well, in my head, I'm flittering around here, but I actually moved from being a front-end developer to being a UX prototyper.
Right.
That's a cool job title, isn't it?
That's a good one. I like that one. Yeah.
Can I have that one?
You can have it. Of course you can. I'll lend it to you.
Writes it down.
And I got myself a job as a UX prototyper working at Just Eat in the design team. And so they had a design team and they had a development team, but this was actually working in the design team. But I was a prototyper, so I was coding. But at that point, I worked with a really really good designer. His name's Mark Jenkins, and he was just awesome. He was just so modest, but also so brilliant. And he was one of the first designers that I worked with that didn't think design was his responsibility. He was the one that was like, it's everybody's responsibility. Coming back to our previous point about, you know, kill the UX designer. And he really embraced me in my role and was like, yeah, so what do you have to say about this? You know, he really cared about my opinions. And so design became far more collaborative, at least for me, in the first time in my career then. And I was like, okay, I'm really interested in this design. Design can be the things that I say from a... this is how it should kind of work in the browser point of view was being valued. So then I could marry technology and design. I could marry accessibility and usability together before sign off. And I was just like, I loved it. I just loved being part of that process and being part of the usability testing and the A/B testing. And from then on out, I started making a transition. And from there on out, my next job was as a UX engineer. So I was doing design and I was doing development. And then I just transitioned from then to where I am now.
Okay.
So, I feel like I put it on there.
Yeah. No, you didn't. Because it's a very interesting career path and it shows how you can kind of just morph between, because we've got so much overlap in the different things that we're doing, you know, between these different job titles, and because we need to work so collaboratively with one another, it does give us a degree of freedom to shift between roles that maybe you don't get within other, you know, jobs. And so it's kind of nice. And the fact that you had somebody, a designer in Mark, who was happy for you to work in that very close collaborative way, enabled that transition to happen. Makes a lot of sense.
I mean, I guess it helped. It wasn't just that he was modest, but he was one of the first designers that I worked with that was very user needs driven. He didn't try to make something cool because it was cool. He was like, well, there's a problem in front of me. Here's the most basic solution that I can do. And I was like, you're speaking my language, because as a developer, you sometimes think in those constraints and you think in terms of simple. And I was like, oh, there's a place at the table for that kind of thinking. But you don't have to design cool things and shiny things and animated things to meet a user need.
Exactly. And then again, it's another different type of design that is often more overlooked. When you talk about design, you think about marketing type design. You know, you think about flashy, attention grabbing, that kind of thing. Well, actually, the kind of design I lean towards, and from the sounds of it, you, is more like designing road signs or designing the signage in an airport or something like that. It's informational. It's, you know, and saying what needs to be said in the simplest way possible.
Yeah.
So you talked about some stuff there. You talked about A/B testing. You talked about working with hand in hand with developers. You talked about sitting on a usability testing. So that kind of brings me on to a little bit to what your typical month looks like. You know, I imagine quite a lot of time is sat in front doing prototyping. But what other kind of things are you doing on a regular basis?
I mean, I'm glad that you asked about that in terms of over a month's yeah. time frame, because what you can do, what I do seems really quite varied. And it might be, I mean, we touched upon it earlier with where does it start? It might be discovering and defining and writing user needs. And not, so there might not be a prototype in sight at that point. There might not be any design, you know, classical design at that point in time. So I think there's three things that I might be doing at a high level. There's discovering user needs. Mm-hmm. And how things work today. There's high level design like IA, navigation, flows and order, frequency mm-hmm. of use, first time experience, second time experience, those high level mm-hmm. things. And then there's like the lower level design, like which you kind of yo-yo between low level and high level design, but like low level design, which what elements should I use for this thing? Yeah. What are even the HTML attributes on that thing? That's going a little bit lower level. Where does that thing sit in relation to everything else on the page? Mm-hmm. Is that a primary thing or a secondary thing? And it, mm-hmm. So this high level and low level thing is you're almost wrestling with that all the time.
Yeah.
And what those things end up producing in the end is a prototype. You end up you know, I'll be sketching, I'll be writing down some thoughts, making some notes, and seeing how other people have done it. And then I'll create a prototype of like the most basic version of a thing before going mm-hmm. out to test.
And do you do the testing yourself, or is it handed across to? Because I mean, you've worked with quite large companies, certainly in your recent history. And of course, the larger the company, the more divided the roles tend to be, and the more specialized the roles are. So I'm quite interested in what you do, where you hand across to someone else, how closely you work with those someone else. So for example, usability testing, is that done by user research? And if so, are you involved in that? How's that work?
Yeah, I mean, I love going to user research sessions. That's the most. It's the most fun because you just never fail to learn something that you think was. You think you designed something that was obvious. It's like what Marcus was saying before. you think that you've designed something that's so simple and obvious, but they will pick up on something else, and you never fail to learn. So I try to go to as much research as possible. That's not always the case. Like if my time can be better spent iterating a prototype while the researcher takes that prototyper out to somewhere halfway across the country, then I might choose not to go, but I try to go to as much of that as possible. But in terms of who's responsible, that will be the user researcher who's responsible for that. But I will try and go along with them, and maybe I'll butt in and ask a few questions. But ultimately, the researcher that I work with, he'll lead that. He'll create some sort of script and research plan, and I might overlook that mm-hmm. and say, well, could you make sure you find out this and really look out for this particular thing? You know, are they seeing that menu and are they opening in it, and do they understand the options within a menu or something like that as a relatively low level detail? Because normally the researcher that I work with, he's great, and he's already thinking about the high level things that he needs to research, so I barely have to get involved in that. But that's his role. And in terms of, and before that happens, when I'm designing, I'm not designing in isolation. I might do some designing in isolation, but I will run it past him and say, you know, what do you think? And I'll run it past mm-hmm. the product owner, and what do they think? I'll run it by my fellow interaction designer and see what they think. And it's a collaborative, messy process.
If you get stuck on something, because when I prototype, sometimes I get stuck on something. I get, you know, there's a particular interaction and I'm not sure whether the way I've come up with is the best way possible.
Yeah.
Do you have an easy mechanism? The way that I solve that as someone who's a team of one is that, you know, I will shove it online somewhere and I will say, you know, I will run a little first click test or a preference test or a, you know, whatever else. A very little lightweight test. Do you use it a user researcher in those kinds of situations, or do you just run it yourself, or do you have some other mechanism of dealing with that?
Well, the first thing I'll do there is I try, one of my strategies is to deliver the most basic thing first. So I try to get out of my own head. And if I'm, that doesn't mean that I don't get my knickers in a twist. I get my knickers in a twist all the time. But what I'll do then is I'll, won't get too emotionally attached to a thing. I'll do the most basic thing and I'll show it to my entire team. And usually that will cover a few of those basic things that I might be getting stuck on. And then the next level to that is, in government, we're quite lucky. We do a lot of qualitative research. So I don't have to use tools so much. I just put the thing. We use the GovUK prototype kit, which actually is a proper high fidelity HTML prototype kit, which is great. And it's quick to prototype in as well.
So a lot of these problems have already been solved, in effect.
That's another subject we kind of need to touch on, don't we? Because there's the GovUK design system where it's got a load of components, a load of patterns and a load of styles that I've already got to work with. And I can just, part of my job is sometimes just assembling the things in the right place, in the right order. It's like, I look at a text box, I was like, is that the right thing to use? Yes, the text box is the right thing to use. I'll put that as question one. Radio buttons, I need radio buttons for this. I need this layout for this.
See, there's an interesting one, isn't there? Because again, that's a different mindset of this kind of designer who is, there should be a term for this, an information-driven designer or an interaction-driven designer rather than a marketing-type designer. I remember early on in my career when, you know, I'd been to art school and, you know, it was all about creativity and that kind of stuff, being driven nuts because I had forced on me this template that I didn't like because it didn't meet my design aesthetics, etc. But actually now, that's good. Those kinds of standardizations, those standard components are a good starting point. But I'm wondering how you feel about it. Do you find working with those kinds of design systems constraining if you weren't involved in creating them in the first place?
I think it depends on the principles of the design system itself. Like how strict is that design system? Does it say that you must use this always, or is it? I don't see design systems as that. I see them as, here's what we know, here's what we have, here's some guidance. Start here because that's cheaper to do that and requires less thinking. Test it and see where it might not fit. I mean, you might not have to test it in order to realize that something doesn't quite fit. You might see a pattern and see that you need to adapt it, or you might need a whole new pattern. That's totally okay. I think that's totally okay. Yeah. I think the main message is to start with the design system, start with what's there, and iterate or change if you need to. And I don't see that as limiting myself, because for me, I mean, I guess we all feel this way. I've just mentioned like text box and radio buttons and level one headings. They've been around for like ever. Is there anything new anymore? you know what I mean? Like, I don't really want to solve. I'm really interested in how someone might improve a thing, but I don't really want to think about a text box anymore. I just want to go, okay, cool, it's a text box. And then I want to think about, well, should that text box go there in this stage of the flow? And how do I ask the question? And what are the words that I use?
Those
are really important. But the fact that I'm using a text box, I don't really want to think about that. I want to think about much bigger problems. And those bigger problems might be high-level things, but those bigger problems might be really low-level things. You know, you might be getting into the nitty-gritty of some sort of autocomplete component and making sure that works, I don't know, responsively on small screens, big screens, with keyboard, with screen readers, with drag and dictate and all the rest of it. That's where, and having a design system gives you scope to spend more energy doing those things. And that's where things get fun.
Yeah, I would totally agree. It gets out of the way having to decide, you know, what border radius you're going to put on a text field. I mean, there's more important problems to solve, aren't there? Okay, so you've built your prototype, you've gone through various rounds of testing. Now, at some stage, do you then hand that across to someone who does the main build, the beta build? And if so, how are you involved at that stage?
So what we've been typically doing over the last 4 months in my current role is we work on Jira, which is a bit of a shame, and that's painful. But we'll sidestep that. And so what we deliver to the deliverable, I guess, to a developer is a story that's got good acceptance criteria with references to screens. And because I'm working on a prototype in order to get insights from testing, I don't think, and because I'm always changing it, I don't really want to give a URL out of a prototype because it will change by the time a developer gets their hands on it. So I might put a URL in there, but just say as a bonus. But really, it's the acceptance criteria and the screenshots that should be the thing that's like the source of truth. But as I said before, you know, where does my job end? But my job, it doesn't end when I've written a user story or helped to write a user story. It's, you know, I'll work with the developers as much as I can. Wherever I'm allowed, I mean, I'm all for basically breaking down silos. So if I can work next to the developer, that's great. And if a developer asks me a question, I will down tools, whatever it is I'm doing, if I possibly can, and work with the developer, because that's to get help them get their thing pushed across to done. Yeah. You know, that's the kind of mentality I have. I'm not saying everyone has that mentality or should have that mentality, but that's what I like to do. And it means that, because you can't get everything perfectly written into a story. You should try really, really hard, and you should have grooming, and you should have planning and all the rest of it. But nothing beats having a conversation and regular dialogue.
How does multivariate testing fit into all of this? Because I mean, you know, you've worked on some major e-commerce sites as well over the years, where obviously multivariate testing is a huge thing. Who does that? Do you see, do you contribute into that? How does that work?
We don't do a lot of, at the moment, I've done no A-B testing in over a year. One of the last times I can remember doing A-B or multivariate testing was at Just Eat. And we used Optimizely. Do you know that?
Yep.
Use
it.
So we used that, and as the UX prototyper that I was at the time, I would write those tests. I would go into the code and click on, you know, new A-B test or whatever, and actually change the code there and then CSS or HTML or JavaScript. So I would be heavily involved in that and heavily involved in the results of that. I remember working closely with the product owner. But in terms of doing that today, I'm quite out of the loop, I've got to admit. We do a lot more qualitative testing rather than A-B testing.
Is that just the current contract you've got, or is it a reflection on the role you see for A-B testing? In other words, do you prefer doing qualitative stuff to A-B testing, or is it just the contract you're doing?
I think it's a mixture of both. I mean, I've worked in two government departments, and they tend not to do well. In my experience, they haven't done much A-B testing. I think there's probably scope for it. But we mostly focus on qualitative testing, and that's where and going back to your second part of that question, which is, you know, what do I prefer? I definitely prefer qualitative testing because I really enjoyed doing A-B multivariate testing at Just Eat. It was fun. You could see that moving a button or changing the text of a button, just simple little things that were relatively cheap to do, you could see how much of an impact they had. I think there's value in that. I just find there's a lot more value. I don't know if it's right to say a lot.
They're
more
very different things. It's hard to. Yeah. It's an unfair question, really, isn't it? Because
it's not one or the other, is it?
No. A/B testing that I've done. The only time that it's really successful is if you've got a heck of a lot of traffic. And I'm guessing if you're doing a kind of a really complicated form, for example, the kind of thing you're doing that might be very specialist, then if you're not getting the traffic through, then you end up, I think, just sort of interpreting the results however you want to. Whereas if you're talking to somebody and getting some actual real human feedback, then you can interpret that as well, but I guess you're less likely to.
Can we rewind 30 seconds and just, can I steal that answer? Because that's great. that's exactly it, isn't it?
Yeah. My pleasure. I haven't said much today. What you've said has been brilliant.
Okay. So we are running out of time, but we've kind of gone into some tangents that I think have been incredibly useful and very good. I do want to, however, wrap up with a question about how you see your role as evolving and changing over time, right? Do you think that you're the job that you're doing today is going to change, or do you imagine yourself moving on to a different job? You know, what do you think the future holds?
So I definitely don't see myself in the near future wanting to be doing other things, or in terms of doing replacing my job with something different. I mean, there's definitely one thing that I want to add to the list is that I want to get better at design facilitation. And I think, you know, learning way more about service. I'm reading about service design at the moment. I'm reading Service Design Doing. Do you know of that book?
Yeah, I've heard of it.
It's a really good book. So I'm trying. What I really want to get better at is facilitating co-design.
Yeah.
Being able to run a really good and inspiring workshop with intimidating stakeholders and all sorts of, like, a multi-disciplinary team with a diverse range of people, and be able to get them all in the one room, and at the end of it, make it really productive. But at the moment, that scares the hell out of me. I'm more of a team player, like a cog in a much bigger wheel. I would say that's how I would describe myself. So, but I want to get much better at that, and I'd like the idea of doing that and doing more coachy, workshoppy things.
Can you envision a world where you maybe are not doing hands-on design as much, and that you're actually doing more of that kind of facility? Well, more like my role, I guess.
Yeah, I want to stay hands-on. I really want to stay hands-on. I love the fact that I've moved from being a front-end developer to a designer by title, but I still get to code a lot. And I still really care about the technical solution. And I really care about the way the interface looks and feels and flows. I really want to stay hands-on with that. So I kind of want to add being able to facilitate to the list of skills as opposed to replace and evolve my role. But that's how I feel today. I feel like I've got so much to learn. I feel like there's so much more to learn. It's never ending. I want to stay hands-on with that. But I can see myself learning more about that and maybe writing another book and maybe doing a video course on the side and supplementing contracting with other things.
What about the role of interaction designer? Do you see that role itself shifting and changing, you know, in the years to come?
I don't know. I really don't know. One thing enough. I will say, though, is that
it's a cruel question.
Is that the role? Yeah, that's pretty tough. I'm like, can I ask you the same question?
Yes.
I was going to say, though, I think the role of a designer, or even more specifically an interaction designer, I think that changes wherever you go. And you kind of have to adapt to the team and the organisation and the project at hand. You might do more of one thing than another. Like, for example, if we had a really good front-end developer thinks as a designer, then maybe I might do less coding because he might just be faster at the coding than me. I don't know. I'm just thinking off the top of my head. So what I'm trying to say is maybe it's not time that will change it. I'm sure it will, but it's also just the culture and the organization, the people that you're working with, that affect these things. And at the moment, I've been kind of lucky to work in government where you've got quite a multidisciplinary team with, like, content designers, user researchers, service designers, developers, and all of those different roles that come together to build something good.
Absolutely.
That's a bit of a cop-out answer, wasn't it? That was a bit of a cop-out answer, but same question to you,
Paul. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you never know what's coming around the corner, do you? I mean, I'm quite interested. I saw a really good talk by Josh Clark recently, where he was talking, I think it was Josh Clark, anyway, whoever, where he was talking about the impact things like machine learning and AI might have on interaction design, and about, you know, how we deal with some of the new technologies and the touch points those have with real people, you know, where sometimes these AIs don't always get it particularly right, as we know from things like, you know, Alexa and Siri, etc. So that's quite an interesting area. And then also, I'm quite interested in how maybe some of the interactions that we have at the moment could just go away, right? And it just happens automatically, you know? A classic example of that is, we don't really need an app in order to open our car door, but it would be great if we just walk up to our car and it opens itself. You know, sometimes an interaction is it should be invisible. And those kinds of things interest me a little bit, but who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, I wonder if the screen really will disappear. I wonder if that will ever disappear. Probably not entirely,
it's like anything. You know, vinyl never disappeared. You know, cassettes didn't disappear, but they just become niche, don't they? So, you know, I suspect that's where it's going to go.
Cassettes.
Anyway, we were running away.
Cassettes. Come on.
They're coming back. No, seriously.
They are the worst thing ever.
I know.
Vinyl's good. I mean, scratches, but, you know.
Yeah. Cassettes. But seriously. Anyway. I know, but that's the
why
thing.
Why? Why are they trendy again? I can't leave that one.
I don't know. I'm not saying cassettes are coming back. I've just heard recently that there is now a growing group of people who are collecting cassettes. Don't ask me why. I want to talk about our second sponsor before this show turns into a 2-hour one. Our second sponsor is actually very apt from what we've been talking about today, which is Optimal Workshop. So Optimal Workshop have got a suite of usability tools to help improve your website navigation, define your information architecture, understanding first clicks, capturing qualitative and quantitative data, loads and loads of stuff that you can do via them. You can run fast, affordable usability testing if, unlike Adam, you don't have a person in-house who does that for you. Can't all have, oh yes, I have a user researcher. He does all of that, or she does all of that. So if you end up having to do it yourself, then look at Optimal Workshop, because you can do it very fast, very cheaply. You can quickly set up and iterate, create studies that you can learn from. That you can reach as many participants as you need. They'll even recruit people for you if you want to. They've got over 60 languages represented. You can do in-person stuff. You can work remotely. And they've got some really great visualization tools which make it really easy to understand the data, because let's be honest, that's quite painful sometimes, and help you be more confident in your design decisions, just as Adam's been talking about all the stuff today. So really, I would encourage you to check that out. It's a tool that I use all the time. You can find out more about it at boag.world/optimal. Right. Now, Adam, I don't know whether you've ever listened to this podcast before, but unfortunately, we have to end every show with a terrible joke that Marcus has found on the internet. Mm. It's a stupid tradition that I have tried to get rid of many, many times, but there is always a public outcry when we do.
I'm quite happy not to do
it. Here is that moment.
But that's it. No more from now on.
I know, but people won't let... because I will get blamed if you drop that.
I was just playing devil's advocate, you know. Yeah, a little bit of reverse psychology there, Paul. This is a joke on the Boag World Slack channel, Bad Jokes channel, Slack channel. It was on there this morning, which did make me giggle. So here we go. Did you hear that Michael Bublé has contracted an unknown, highly contagious disease? They're calling it the bubonic plague. The bubonic plague. I can't even say it.
You ruined a perfectly terrible joke. Yeah. You made it a bad joke even worse there. Brilliant.
The shame.
Thank you. All right, Adam, thank you. Adam, thank you so much for joining us on the show. Yeah, I hope it wasn't too painful an experience. And thank you, everybody, who has been listening to the show. I hope you found it useful. Next week, we have a show with Mike Coos, illustrator, designer, photographer, when he's going to talk about his experiences. But until then... thanks for listening and goodbye. Bye.